The Castle on the Hill. Wufferl seemed quieter than usual the next morning. He lay in bed beside me, round cheeks flushed, sleep still glazing his eyes, and listened without a word as I told him about my dream. "We went together to the white sand beach," I said. "We saw the Queen of the Night, a witch trapped in an underwater grotto there. She was very frightening." Wufferl murmured his astonishment as I told him about how we escaped from the grotto and ended up giving the night flower to Hyacinth. But his wonder felt muted, his attention scattered. The glaze in his eyes gave them a feverish shine. "Are you all right, Wufferl?" I asked when I finished my story. He shrugged and curled up tighter in bed. I glimpsed a tiny scar on his thumb from where he had bitten it in his sleep.
"My throat is just a little dry," he said, and dozed off again.
Papa always left early and did not come back until later in the day, when Wufferl switched from practicing on his violin to the clavier. So the morning hours were mine, a time when I could play without being disturbed, when no one came in to check on my progress, or how many times I had run flawlessly through a minuet. Mama was out, so the only person with me this morning was Wufferl. Now that he knew about my composition and had managed to keep it from Papa, I felt safer with him nearby. Someone with whom I could share the burden of a secret. He sat with me on the clavier's bench, his elbows propped up on the keys, watching intently as I played my scale. After I paused to turn to a different piece in my notebook, he said to me quite abruptly,
"I wish you would write more music."
I stopped to look at him. Wufferl flipped to the second-to-last page of my notebook and pointed out the few measures I'd written.
"You never finished this one," he said.
All I could hear was my father's voice in my head and the words he had spoken to Mama over dinner yesterday.
"Nannerl makes an excellent companion for Wufferl. Together, their fame is twice what it could be. Can you imagine the spectacle we could create if one day Nannerl performed one of Wolfril's compositions?"
Mama had listened and nodded. Of course, it would be preposterous to suggest that I could compose my own pieces. In truth, I was an excellent companion. But I would be nothing more than a performer for my brother's compositions. If I wanted immortality, it would not come from my writing. The words hung, weighted, around my neck. Composition was for men. It was an obvious rule. What would others think of my father if they knew I composed behind his back, that he could not even control his own daughter? What kind of girl shamed her father by secretly doing a man's work? The image of my compositions burning in the fire flashed before me, the thought of my father's stern eyes. I had seen Papa toss letters in a rage into the stove, remembered watching the embers light the edges of those papers. The memory made me wince. Even seeing my little tune exposed here on the page was making my heart quicken. I glanced nervously toward the door, half expecting Papa to step in at this very moment, and then turned to a different minuet.
"I can't," I replied to Wufferl.
He frowned.
"Why not?"
he asked.
"I'm afraid to." "But don't you want to?"
"Of course, but it is different with me."
"Music is music. The source of it does not matter so much."
I sighed. "Wufferl," I chided him. And he had the grace to give me a guilty look.
"I cannot do what you do. It is something you will never, ever understand."
He pouted at me in frustration. His tongue had sharpened when it came to composition.
"Everyone fancies himself a musician," he'd complained to me. "No one respects the soul of it."
I'd seen him turn Papa's face red with embarrassment when he once scoffed at the skills of a local noble who had given composition, in his words, a whirl.
"Charlatan," Wulfril had called him to his face. I would have been reprimanded harshly for saying such a thing to a nobleman, but Papa just chuckled about it later. My brother did not reply again. Instead, he hurried off, and I returned to my lessons. Minutes later, he returned with a quill and inkwell. "Wulfril," I exclaimed, pausing in my playing. But he did not apologize. Instead, he adjusted the writing instruments and pointed the quill's feather in my direction. I began to tremble at the sight of it. This was not Wulfril at work. This was God taunting me, tempting me to write again. Or perhaps it was Hyacinth, his will bubbling up from my brother's sweet eyes. Was I hearing the words of the princeling on Wulfril's lips?
"Will you do it?"
he whispered eagerly to me.
"Wulfril, this is Papa's," I said.
"How will we explain that it is not in its place?" Wulfril simply closed the notebook and gestured to a loose sheet propped against the clavier stand.
"I have started to write," he said. "Papa will know the ink is here because I use it daily. How would he know about you?"
I felt my cheeks grow warm at the thought.
"But, Wulfril," I protested, "where will I write mine? I cannot continue to compose in my notebook. Sooner or later, Papa will see, and that will be the end of it." "Write on loose sheets," he said. "Then you can fold them up and hide them in our bedroom."
My music, my measures, each one painstakingly written, curling into ash in the fire. The fear lingered, holding me back. But my brother's eyes were still on me, and with them, I felt the ache again to write, his encouragement pushing me forward. If Papa discovered I was composing, he might burn my work as he burned the letters that upset him. But he couldn't do that if he never found it. Wulfril finally shrugged, impatient with my long hesitation, and wandered off to continue his own compositions. I stayed at the bench and stared at the quill in silence, thinking. Ink dripping down the side of the well had touched the clavier stand, staining the fibers of the blank parchment. In the mornings, I would find the quill and inkwell on the stand, along with the smudged pages of music that Wulfril had composed the afternoon before. Papa saw them in the evenings and would show them to me in a merry temper, as if I did not know what they sounded like. Wulfril was right. Our father had no reason to think that I would also compose. Every morning, when he was not at home and Mama had left for errands, when only Wulfril and I were in the music room, I would take the folded sheet of music from the bottom of my bedroom drawers and add measures to it. My pages were not as clean as Wulfril's. Under Papa's watchful guidance, Wulfril wrote more than I did. He composed so quickly, in fact, that he produced stacks of paper at the end of every day. Mama was constantly sending Sebastian out to buy more sheets. When I looked at my brother's pages, I would marvel at how sparse his changes were, how much of it already seemed fully formed in his head. My thoughts shifted more. I would write entire lines and then cross them out. I would take a measure of music and then flip the harmony to see how it worked. I would go over and over a page before I finally produced a finished copy of it. At the end of the day, my work would bleed with ink, a mess of moving thoughts that, to me, told a story of how the music came to be. I would run a hand over the dried notes and hear the early drafts in my head. My heart would keep time with the rise and fall of the melody. In those moments, the room around me faded away. My surroundings changed into a secret world of sound and peace. I would stir out of that dream of creation with tears in my eyes. Wulfril often watched me write. Sometimes he asked me questions, but mostly he sat beside me in silence, his chin propped in his hands as I worked. When he wrote his pieces,
I could hear traces of my own style filtering into his, like milk curling into tea. Vufril's handwriting, childish though it was, looked very much like our father's with its coiled tails. Mine, untrained and unrefined, did not. From what my brother shared with me about his lessons with Papa, I learned the proper format for recording my work. Eventually, my writing began to look as polished as my brother's, nearly identical to his hand. In case Papa discovered the sheets of music in my drawer, he could assume that they belonged to Vulfril, and I would be spared. Then, several weeks after my dream of the nightflower, Vufril fell ill. At first he coughed a little at night, nothing much, only enough to wake me for a moment. Shortly after, his skin began to look paler than it usually did. One morning I went to the clavier and found Vufril sound asleep by the windowsill, his breath forming a circle of fog against the glass. The tiny wound on his thumb still had not disappeared, and the skin around it was flushed and pink, hot to the touch. He did not even wake when I shook him. It was only when I began to play that he finally sat up and looked around, dazed.
"Oh, Nanril, it's you," he said when he saw me.
Then he turned, his eyes far away, and touched the window's glass with his small fingers.
"Hyacinth was outside."
I looked down at the street, half expecting to see the princeling's familiar smile. But nothing was there. The hairs on my arms rose. Perhaps Hyacinth was appearing to Vulfril alone, as he sometimes did to me. What did he want with him? At first, my parents did not dwell on Vulfril's bout of sickness. Children tended to catch illnesses, especially in these cooler months, and Vulfril had always been a frail child. But the illness lingered. It worsened. His dark eyes turned bright with fever, and his delicate skin gleamed with sweat and angry red bumps. Papa did not sleep on the first few nights that Vulfril's rash broke out. He sat in our bedchamber and looked on with a grim face as Mama patted my brother's forehead with a damp cloth. As the illness hung on, he began to pace.
"I have had to cancel a performance already," he said in a low voice to my mother. "Soon we will cancel a second, and for the Postmaster General, Count Wenzel Parr, no less."
"The Count can wait." There was an edge to Mama's voice tonight. "Vufril will recover before you know it, and you can resume your schedule." Papa frowned.
"The Archbishop has already cut my salary. 400 gulden. How is a family to live on 400 gulden a year? We can't afford to cancel a third."
"Well, you will just have to wait, won't you?" Mama answered. Papa turned away from her in a huff. As he passed me, he paused.
"If Vulfril is not well by next week," he said, "you will have to perform alone."
"Yes, Papa," I replied.
If he was upset enough to raise his voice at my mother, then I did not dare add to it. Alone. It was a frightening thought, performing without my brother. But somewhere deep inside me, a voice also stirred to life.
"The attention will be yours alone."
I joined Mama in Vulfril's bedchamber, for I could not sleep either, and watched my brother toss and turn with fever. When she would at last fall asleep in exhaustion, and Vulfril would wake up, I would hold his hand and tell him more stories to keep him from crying. Finally, one night, my mother and father left to seek out a doctor for help. I alone remained beside Vulfril, turning my pendant in my hand as if to give my brother good fortune. When he woke to see me at his side, he squinted and began to cry.
"My skin burns, Nanril," he murmured.
His hands reached up to scratch, but I forced them back down. He protested weakly.
"My knees and elbows are hurt."
His joints were swollen,
I could see the rounded look of them. It was such a pitiful sight that I squeezed his hand and tried to give him a smile.
"It will all pass soon," I reassured him as I wiped his tears away. "And you'll be back in front of your clavier, I promise."
He looked away and toward the window.
"Do you think Hyacinth is watching us right now?"
Vufril asked. Hyacinth again. I felt a chill. Why was he in Vulfril's thoughts so much these days? I tried to think back to the dream I'd once had. The Nightflower, the witch. Hadn't Hyacinth given Vulfril something? The scar on his thumb had finally faded, but I found myself touching the spot where it had been, trying to remember. The back of my neck prickled, as if someone else might be in the room with us. Did Hyacinth know that Vulfril would fall ill? The thought so unsettled me that I immediately dismissed it. It was possible, I suppose. But perhaps, more likely, Vulfril's fever had been brought on by wind and rain.
"I don't know," I finally said to my brother.
He turned toward me, eager to be distracted, and I obliged.
"Maybe he is sitting somewhere in the kingdom's forests right now, perched high on the roots of a tree, watching us through a round mirror." "Do you think he is sad like me?"
Vulfril said.
"Very sad," I replied, and reached out to stroke his damp hair. "When Hyacinth weeps, his tears form puddles at the bottom of the trees. This is how the drowning pools form."
"Maybe he isn't in the forest anymore," Vulfril said. "But going somewhere else that we haven't seen. A castle in the hills?"
He burst into a fit of coughs that brought tears to his eyes.
"Yes, a castle in the hills," I said. "Perhaps this was his old home, the palace where the princeling once lived."
Vufril nodded, grumpy.
"What happened to him? It must have been very tragic."
Tragic. Vufril's words reminded me of the look I'd seen on Hyacinth's face in the trinket shop's grotto, a moment of sadness that was there and then gone. What had happened to the princeling in his past?
"There is a river that surrounds all sides of the hill," I went on as I pondered. "And the grass at the very bottom near the water is lush and green, but the grass higher up is dry and dying, for it hasn't rained in months. Hyacinth has to swim across the river to reach the castle, but because he cannot swim, he can only sit on the banks and yearn for his lost home."
"Why do you think he left?"
Vulfril whispered. I thought of little Hansel and Gretel abandoned in the woods, stumbling across the witch's house of gingerbread. I thought of the smith of Oberarl, offering his daughter to the devil in exchange for the healing waters of the Gastein Valley. The fairy tales swirled in my mind as I tried to think of what Hyacinth's history might be. Finally, something came to me. I looked at Vulfril. My story came out hushed, dark as the shadows flickering in the corners of the room.
"The castle is crumbling now, for no one has been there in a long time. Years ago, a young king named Giovanni ruled the land with his beautiful queen, whom he loved dearly. In fact, everyone loved the queen. Even the great sun, who bestowed his golden magic of fire unto her so that the land flourished under her warmth. The light and the heat restricted the land's fairy creatures to the woods, where their dangerous magic could not harm the kingdom. All was well for many years. When the queen finally announced that she would have her first child, the people rejoiced and counted themselves very lucky indeed. Everyone waited eagerly for the birth."
As I spoke, Vulfril grew quiet, his aches momentarily forgotten, so that the only sound in the room became that of my voice.
But the queen fell ill when the first snows arrived that winter. Her rosy cheeks drained of color, and her shining hair became dark and limp and damp from her lingering fever. The king's doctors would boil their medicines and feed her teas made from strange, exotic roots. The queen began having terrible nightmares. During the day, she saw visions of death and suffering, and at night she witnessed strange, dark figures glide past her windows and her bed. She grew paler, even as her unborn child swelled in her belly. The story unfolded, and my voice began to change. It became wilder and deeper, as if it belonged to another. The words did not quite match with the movements I made with my lips. A strange fog in my head left me feeling distant. The candle burned lower. From the corner of my eye, I could see a shadow at the edge of the room growing, until it looked as slender and graceful as the dancing shape of a princeling. The queen gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl, in the spring of that year. Although ravaged by illness, she did not die, but sank deep into a permanent madness. Frightened for her, the king assigned his champion to her side in an attempt to keep her safe. But it did no good. She rose one morning, took her baby boy in her arms, and walked out into the forest, murmuring about the fairies calling for her in the woods. "What happened to them?" Vulfril whispered. "I don't know," I replied, but through the fog in my mind, I could hear someone else continue the story, as if the answer had existed all along. "The fairies are always looking for something to devour. They find the sadness in souls particularly enticing, and when they happen upon them, they will do whatever they can to get it."
Vulfril looked grave.
"Then they must certainly have taken her," he said.
I shivered at the finality in his words as I went on.
"When the queen and her son did not return, the entire kingdom went to search for the pair. No one ever found them. The grieving king lost all will to live, leaving his castle unguarded and untended so that it began to crumble from disrepair. He ordered his daughter locked away in the tallest tower of the castle so that the fairies could not steal her away, too. He lost his memory over time. He forgot his wife and his two children. The son, devastated by the young queen's disappearance, abandoned the kingdom and plunged the land into eternal night. The crops withered. When the king finally died, the people fled the land until the castle stood empty and alone.
What about the princess?
No one knows, although some say that she is still locked away in the castle's highest tower, waiting for someone to remember her.
My words seemed so true in this moment that I found myself thinking of the fairy witch trapped in the cove. She had told me how lonely she was, too. Vulfril sighed deeply and sank his head into the bed's pillows.
"Hyacinth is the son who disappeared," he added. "He comes back to the edge of the river every morning and every evening to stare at the castle. But he can never reach it. He cannot swim." "He cannot swim."
Suddenly, I remembered Hyacinth telling me this in my dream of the Nightflower. Vulfril, instinctively, knew this too. I hesitated for a moment, surprised at where the story ended. In the corners of the room, the shadow that had been a princeling now faded to a flicker. I could still taste the wind of his voice on my tongue, as if he had told his story through me. For the first time, I thought I understood why Hyacinth had chosen to become my guardian. He had been abandoned, too, left behind like I feared I might someday be,
forever yearning for a world to which he cannot return.
This is what happens to children who are forgotten, Vulfril, I ended, leaning over to kiss his forehead. I was exhausted now, and the castle had suddenly become too real in my mind. When I looked down at my brother, I saw that he had fallen mercifully back to sleep.
They stay forever trapped, I murmured to myself. Nothing but a lost memory.
Vufril's doctor, a man named Herr Anton von Bernhard, came late that night in a quiet flurry to stir a cup of medicine for my brother. He looked at Vulfril's eyes, listened to his heart and his lungs, and studied the angry rash on his skin. In the candlelight I could see Mama's face. She wanted to say something, perhaps ask Herr von Bernhard a few questions, but each time she looked at Vulfril she closed her mouth as if she had forgotten what she had to say.
Scarlet fever, I imagine, Herr von Bernhard told my father afterward. See the bright red color of his tongue. Keep him in bed and in a room with fewer windows. He rubbed his temples as if it were a nervous habit. I will come again tomorrow and give him a dose of Angelica. He should drink warm water, boiled thoroughly.
We moved Vulfril into a smaller chamber the very next morning, one with only a single window and dim light. Each evening, Herr von Bernhard came to give him medicine, and each morning Sebastian would open the window briefly to let the sick air out. Sometimes Mama would sit with Vulfril, while I retreated to play the clavier, Papa at my side, absently correcting my mistakes. The halt to our performances stretched on. Papa's bright mood from our successful Vienna trip darkened. I performed alone before the Elector of Bavaria. Without my brother, the court's attention stayed only on me, and when they burst into applause at the end of my performance, I felt so stunned that for a moment I forgot to curtsy in return. The tips of my fingers still tingled from the thrill of my music. My eyes went automatically to the space beside Papa, where Vulfril would be, but only a court official stood in his place. Behind him, I thought I saw a pale, lithe figure stride through the crowd, his blue eyes fixed on me in approval. I turned my gaze back down to the floor. The thought of my brother lying stricken in bed clashed with the sound of thunderous applause.
Manuel, listen to what the newspaper says, my father said several nights later as we sat for supper. The girl played the most difficult sonatas and concertos quite accurately and in the best of taste.
He smiled at me. This was such a rare sight that I did not react quickly enough to smile back. My heart soared.
They do not say this lightly, Nanril. Well done.
A newspaper article. Papa had praised me for it. I reread it in bed that night, going over the words until I fell asleep with it still clutched in my hands. In my dreams, I curtsied before an applauding opera house covered in night flowers. My mother and father sat in the front row. My brother was nowhere to be seen. Up in the balconies, Hyacinth leaned against the banisters and watched me with a look of pride. I shook awake, my eyes still turned up in his direction. But Vulfril stayed ill. My enthusiasm dampened every time I passed his room and saw him delirious with fever in his bed. Papa muttered frequently under his breath. Sometimes I heard him speak harshly to my mother in the next room, then lower his voice in apology. Your father is simply frightened, Nanril, Mama would say when I asked her about it. He loves Vulfril dearly, and he worries for us.
You worry for us, I replied, and you never speak harshly.
Mama smiled a little. I am your mother, darling. What good would that do? One night, when both of my parents sat by Vulfril's bed with me, I saw something stir in the corners of the room. The shadow flickered, turning sharper and sharper, until finally it materialized into the shape of Hyacinth. He had grown taller and more slender since I last saw him, matching me in height and paleness, as if he too were edging out of his youth, growing from boyhood and into the body of a young man. As I watched him, he came to kneel beside me. His eyes, serious and silent, lingered on my brother.
"I know what you are thinking, Fräulein," he said to me. "You think that perhaps I did this to him when he pricked his finger on the night flower."
"Did you?" I finally asked.
"Your brother pricked his finger only so that a drop of his blood could spill inside the kingdom," he replied. "I wanted to be sure that I had a link to his lifeblood and his talent, just as I have a link to yours through your notebook."
The thought of Wulfril's blood being his link to the kingdom sent a shiver tingling through me. "What will happen the next time we step into the kingdom?" I said. "What other dangers will we have to face? Will the kingdom require more of our blood?"
Hyacinth shook his head. "The next time you will come alone. I only need you for your next task."
"Why is that?" I asked.
"Because, Fräulein..."
Hyacinth looked at me, his eyes pulsing in the dark.
"The fulfillment of your wish has always been about you."
Me. I remembered my name printed alone in the newspaper article. My father's praise only for me. It had all happened after fetching the night flower for Hyacinth. When I didn't answer, Hyacinth turned his attention back to Wulfril and heaved a wistful sigh.
"Poor little boy," he said. "Look at the color of his face, as if he is hovering between two worlds."
Two worlds, the kingdom and ours. In his musical voice was such a sound of pining that I felt truly sorry for him. I thought of his past that I had told Wulfril, the way the kingdom's forests had claimed him along with the queen, and wondered if he missed the home that he had been stolen from. Perhaps this was why he had chosen to help me, one forgotten child to another.
"What will my next task be, then?" I asked, looking again at him.
But Hyacinth had disappeared as quickly as he'd come, leaving nothing but emptiness beside me. I blinked, disoriented to be alone all of a sudden. Beside me, Papa and Mama looked undisturbed, their heads still bowed in prayer. I waited, half expecting Hyacinth to appear again. Had he ever been in here? The air seemed chillier now, and when I glanced outside the window, I noticed a ghost-like figure shrouded in dark colors drift by. Hadn't the queen from the kingdom of Back seen those figures too, floating shadows in the mist, the pieces of her dreams? Hadn't they surrounded the castle on the hill and reached for her as she lay ill? I trembled as another glided by, then another. Now their shapes condensed, turned solid, so that I could make out their red eyes and black hoods, their twisted fingers on long, spindled hands. They grew as the candle burned low by Wulfril's bedstand. The queen had not recovered from her nightmares, and instead had fallen into madness. I pictured her in my mind again, afraid and alone, lost in a world that those around her could not see. Perhaps they had frightened Hyacinth away too. I rose from my place and left the room, returning with two more candles. I replaced the dying one, then set another right beside it. Mama watched me silently. "It is too dark in here," I said to her. "Now it is better." The figures outside the window slowly faded away in the brighter light, until they looked like nothing more than the flag that flapped against the glass.